This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 137, Teeth Pulling by Appointment. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Daniel Prue. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a new home at the Smithsonian for the original Enterprise shooting model, starships landing in Japan, changes to StarTrek.com's discussion boards, and a Star Trek strategy game headed for your mobile device. Then in the feature, we're joined by Drew Stewart and Mariel Kieran to discuss the original series episode, Spectre of the Gun. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Daniel. It's great to have you back on the Ready Room with me. It's just been a couple of weeks since you were here on the show, but we had fun last time. But today we get to, you know, travel to the wild, wild west.
Yeah, you know, it's a different environment. It's something I'm totally not prepared for, but I think we'll do okay.
You're not going to just quote lines from A Fistful of Data's today, are you?
Well, I mean, I could try to do my Troy Western voice. I don't think I'm going to try. I don't think there's really no reason to ever do that.
Well, Daniel, let's just jump right on into news. And speaking of A Fistful of Data's, it is from the sixth season of The Next Generation. And we have a quick thing here. Now, we talked about the TNG season six Blu-rays and Chain of Command last week, so we're not going to really go into them today. We did want to let everyone know that the release date has been postponed. It was going to drop on June 3rd, and now these two Blu-rays, the standalone Chain of Command and the Season 6 set, are going to drop on June 24th. And there's no explanation given that I've seen so far as to why they're delayed. My guess would be probably something to do with getting the extras finished up, but that's just pure speculation on my part. So we'll look forward to those, and then we can hear Marina Sirtis do her Troy Wild West, old Western accent voice.
In high definition.
In high definition. And 7.1 surround sound.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Counselor Troy's 7.1 surround sound old West action.
Yeah. 7.1 surround sound Alexander. That's exactly what I'm looking forward to about season six.
All right. Well, let's go on to our first real big story today. And this is some great news today. We're doing a TOS episode here on the Ready Room. And the original 11-foot Enterprise model, which has been in the Smithsonian since 1974 when Paramount donated it to the museum, is going to get a new home, a much more prominent placement, because for the last 15 years, it's been on a lower level as the centerpiece of a gift shop. But Daniel, there is news from the museum now that it is going to once again take what I consider to be its rightful place in the main entrance.
You know, Chris, I'm glad that you've had me on for this show because I don't know how aware of it you are, but I have just moved into the Washington metro area.
Oh, that's
in
right.
The past six months. So, and when I first moved down here, I did get to make it to the Air and Space Museum. Unfortunately, we were there about an hour before it closed, so I didn't get to go through the whole museum, and I didn't actually get to see the Enterprise. So I'm very excited that it will find a new home right in the main hall, and I will make sure when it gets there that I go and visit and take lots of pictures and send them out, because this is really, really exciting. This is kind of, I like you, I agree, this is kind of where it belongs.
Definitely. It's a shame that they would put it, you know, as the centerpiece of a gift shop. I mean, you can look at it and think like, well, when people go to a museum, they always go to the gift shop. And so everyone unless they get there an hour before it closes, Daniel, would eventually see it. But, you know, it's something that I think really needs to be a more prominent display. And so what they're going to be doing is the museum has received a $30 million donation from Boeing to fund the transformation of the Milestones of Flight Hall. This is a popular exhibit that they have there, but they're going to be refurbishing it, and it's going to be there in the main entrance. And they are doing it in honor of the 40th anniversary of the Air and Space Museum, which is coming up in 2016, which coincidentally is a big year for Star Trek as well. It's the big 5-0 for our beloved franchise. So it's great that those two things are going to be coming together. What they're going to be doing is they're going to be bringing a number of prominent ships and craft from Earth's history. They're going to have John Glenn's Friendship 7 spacecraft, Charles Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis, and Telstar, the first communication satellite in space, as centerpieces of this, along with the Enterprise, which, you know, will take us through to that future vision of mankind as well.
And, I just love this. I love the fact that Star Trek, you know, in any of its incarnations, is used to represent the future. I think that it's just a wonderful thing and a beautiful thing. And it makes all of this, everything we do, to me, it makes it seem worth it, because it's like, this is where we want to be. We want to be, you know, on the original Enterprise in 150 years or whatever. And it's really super awesome that the Smithsonian is putting it there. And listen, anybody that gets, once this the exhibit is put up, go. If you're in the Washington area, it's free. Just go. Go. You can actually see this piece of Star Trek history. Just go and see it.
Oh, definitely. I wish I could get there. I'm unfortunately too far away. It's amazing. I've never been to Washington. I don't know why. It's like when I grew up in the States, I've been to all these other capitals of countries around the world. I've never been to the capital of the United States. Shame on me, right?
It's okay. I mean, we didn't really have the Enterprise display prominently until this, so I can understand. Maybe you were upset that they put it in the gift shop, and that's probably why. I understand, Chris.
Well, I was going to go there, and I was going to try to buy it. You know, I'll take that right up there. That's not for sale.
How much for that? I have 15 bars of gold-pressed Latin. Where would that get me?
How much is that starship in the window? While we're on the topic, Daniel, you're known, of course, as the... We talked about this, I guess it was on Warp 5, actually, right? A couple of weeks ago we did that. I mentioned that you're known around the network as the nacelle guy. Now, this is the original shooting model for the original series. How do you feel about the nacelles on the original TOS model, original Enterprise model?
They are the primary nacelles, right? These are the nacelles that birthed all other nacelles. This is what, this is very exciting to me. It's the original series Enterprise. I know a lot of people, a lot of Star Trek fans really like the A better than the original.
The movie refit. I like that ship too.
I like the rounded nacelles better. I like perfect rounded symmetry, a little more credence. But I'm excited to see it. I really think 11-foot model, that just blows my mind. I've literally never seen an Enterprise that big up close and personal. And I know I'm the TNG guy, right? Like I do Earl Grey with my co-hosts, but how can someone like me not appreciate what the original Enterprise did for not just Star Trek, but the whole world, really, you know? And this is why I think that they're putting it in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. This is an incredible honor. There's no, it's not like they do this for everything. This is the Enterprise. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, the Jupiter lander is not in there from Lost in Space, right? Right in the middle of the exhibit. So, I was talking to Doug Drexler on Continuing Mission a few weeks ago, and he did the visuals for Star Trek Continues. And he talked about this particular model and about how do you get the feel of the original series right when you're doing the CGI. And he pointed out that it's to remember that the original model was 11 feet long. It wasn't the length of what the ship was supposed to be if it were in real life. You know, so you can't build your CGI model to that length. You've got to build it to be an 11-foot model like the original, and that's the key to pulling off the effects. It was very, very interesting. So about the model, the museum said that this 3.4-meter, 11-foot model of the fictional Starship Enterprise will go on display in the reimagined Boeing Milestones of Flight Hall. Star Trek pushed the boundaries of network television with its depiction of a mixed-sex, racially integrated, multinational crew and its attention to contemporary social and political issues. It will join other significant artifacts in this gallery to showcase the importance of popular culture's influence on society. And I think that's great. I think it's great that Star Trek is still being recognized for that. There are over 7 million people who visit this museum every year, and having the Enterprise there is going to work alongside the Abramsverse films, of course, to continue to elevate, I think, the presence of Star Trek in the popular culture today, even though we don't have new Star Trek on television.
Yeah, I imagine little children who are wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, they're going to go visit the Air and Space Museum, and they're going to see this, and they're going to be like, you know, I was just going to be awed by the beauty of this design, and maybe someday I could go on a ship like this. Who knows?
That would be nice. I mean, you did tell me, right, that if we were going to go to Mars, you would be one of the people that would sign up, right?
I would, especially if it was on the Enterprise, you know.
Right.
That would be incredible, yeah. But absolutely, absolutely.
Well, we'll put a link in the show notes to this, and go over and check it out, because there's actually a video as well that's produced by the museum that tells you about the project. And it has some artists, it has some scenes from the actual museum, and I believe it also has some artist renditions of what's going to be coming up as well when this is ready in 2016, in time for the 40th anniversary of the museum. Let's go on to the next story, Daniel. Now, I was really excited about this because I have been asked repeatedly on the shows by fellow hosts if I am collecting the Star Trek official Starships collection from Eagle Moss, which is available in the UK, Ireland, the US, Canada. And I've had to say over and over that sadly I'm not, because I live in Japan and we just can't get any of this stuff here. Well, StarTrek.com had the story up this weekend that they are expanding distribution and the Starships collection is coming to Japan. And it is being distributed here by De Agostini, which is a publisher that they make everything here. You go in the bookstores and you can buy DVDs, like bi-weekly release DVDs. My daughter gets them for ballet. You can get fact files and models. Like, you can collect parts of cars and then build the car over the course of 6 months by getting a new part every other week. That's the kind of stuff they do. And they are going to be distributing the Starship collection here in Japan. So, of course, I immediately went to the website and I pre-ordered. So I've got my order in. It's going to be here. It's going to be available on May 20th. And interestingly, yesterday here was Sunday, April 13th. And it says right on the website that today it's available for pre-order from April 13th. So I'm probably one of the first people in Japan, I would bet, to pre-order the Star Trek Starships collection.
What an interesting, set of ships that they have here, though, right? Like, so it says here that the first is the D, and then the 1701 refit, and then the NX-01?
Yeah.
What? Like, they do that. It just seems kind of random, like, what ships they pick.
It does seem that way a little bit, right? I was thinking about that myself, and I was thinking that it makes sense that the 1701D would be the first ship, because I feel like for most people these days, TNG is the Star Trek that people think of first. You think of Captain Picard and you think of the 1701D. Now, the second ship is the 1701 refit, which we just talked about a little bit. And that makes sense too, because when people think of the movies, that's the first ship that they think of, is that refit, which was also the A. But then, like you say, yeah, the NX-01 being the next one was kind of an odd choice. Like, you would think maybe Voyager would be next, right? Or the bird of prey or a D7 would be next, or a Borg cube. But no, it's the NX-01.
You know, and I mean, as I don't know, is this like, because they're currently available here,
right,
you know, in Europe and Canada and stuff. So like, I don't know, like, is it like TNG first in Japan or
no?
And then the original series and then Enterprise? Like, that's like totally different than it is here.
You're right, just a little bit. I'm looking at the Eagle Moss website, who is the distributor for the US, Canada, UK, and Ireland. Their order was 1701D, then the 1701 movie refit, then the Klingon Bird of Prey, but number four is the NX-01. So ours is just reversed. We're going to get the NX-01 third, and then we're going to get the Klingon Bird of Prey. And then the fifth one is the Romulan Warbird over there in the States and in Europe.
Which is a great choice. But it's really interesting because I would have put... I like Enterprise, don't get me wrong, but I would have put NX-01 way down on the list.
Like, yeah.
You know, like you said, Voyager would probably have been what I assumed would have been the next popular choice or what they would have gone with next. But
yeah, you would think so just based on lead ships from a series, right? Mm-hmm. So they're doing the same thing in Japan that they've done elsewhere, which is sort of a stepped pricing structure, you know, for introducing people to this. The first one in the US was $4.95, and the first one here in Japan is 499 yen. So it's pretty much the same, actually slightly cheaper for us. The second one here will be 1,299 yen, which is roughly about $13. In the US, apparently, it went up to $20, $19.95, right away after that first one. So we're getting a break on the second one, which might be a reflection of just the popularity of Star Trek here in Japan, the fact that they're trying to get more people into it. From the third one onward, though, we're going to be paying 2,495 yen, or roughly $25, which is more expensive than the US, where it does settle in at $19.95 for each model after that.
You know, these are nice looking ships though. So, I don't begrudge you pre-ordering them as soon as you can, because they're actually pretty nice looking models.
Yeah, they are really nice. And that's one reason I am glad that the NX-01 is the third ship, because there aren't a lot of good models of the NX-01, certainly not affordable ones. There have been some really nice artisan ones made. So this would be a great way to get your hands on those. But I'm really, really excited. I've been waiting for these ever since they came out. I've been really bummed that I haven't been able to get them, because I've got a lot of desk space here in the studio, right around my workstation. And it's just crying out to have starships scattered everywhere. And by this time next year, I won't be able to put my iPad down because I'll have so many starships on my desk.
And that's not a bad problem to have.
It is not. It is not. And they're much nicer than the old Micro Machines ships, which I used to have. So, we're going to get some special gifts here. Light up Borg cube gift, and also a Star Trek keychain of the TOS Delta insignia for those who pre-order by July 6th. And, like I said, I've got my order in, so I can't wait. And also, I'll put a link in the show notes for those of you who are interested in going to see how it's being presented to a Japanese audience. They have a great page there on the website. It's all in Japanese, so you may not be able to read it, but you might find it interesting anyway. All right, well, let's go on to the next story, Daniel. This one, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on, because it caught me. I was surprised when I heard it, while at the same time, I can understand the thought process behind it. And this is the fact that StarTrek.com, starting in May, is going to be closing down their discussion boards and their fan galleries.
Weird, right? This is strange.
That was my first reaction, yeah.
I don't want to get too excited or too into anything. My immediate reaction would be, what's going on in May? Or what's going to be announced in May? There's got to be a reason that, you know, I guess, you know, we could assume that, like they say here, you can use any of the other official forums like Facebook or Twitter or Google or Instagram or anything. But to me, it's just like, well, okay, why? though? Why would they? I can't imagine that it's too much to maintain it or something. I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, my mind immediately goes to, oh, they're going to announce a new something in May. But I, you know, that's what I would hope for, and it's probably not going to happen. But I wish that they were doing this in order to prepare for like a new show or something. That's
A new show. Now, a lot of people would jump on board for that. I don't know. That's an interesting point you make, because I hadn't really thought about that. I felt, like you say, I don't think there would be that much overhead in maintaining them. Although, when you have boards like StarTrek.com has, and you have that many people interacting, you really do have to devote resources to moderating that and monitoring that. So that is a resource. And they already have their Facebook page, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, and Pinterest, which they mention as being the places that you can now go to have your lively conversations and share your favorite photos, as they say. And so maybe like they're already pouring resources into social media, and they feel, as I do sometimes, that discussion boards are kind of outdated. Like it's sort of like the 90s. It's sort of like maybe the 2000s. And these days, it feels like an antiquated way of sharing. But I don't completely feel that way, because the problem with social media, like Facebook, for example, is that the interface and the timeline, it doesn't allow you to create categories and discussion threads in the way that you really want to do on a discussion board. So I think that it may make it harder for people to interact with each other about Star Trek. Like it might make it easier for people, make it easier for StarTrek.com to interact with fans, but it will make it more difficult for fans to interact with other fans, I think.
Right. So like in those spaces, how it exists is that essentially all us as fans are responding to whatever Paramount or, you know, StarTrek.com essentially puts out.
Yeah, CBS in the case of TV. Yeah.
We don't get to actively create conversations. We have to respond to them. It's more of a passive role as opposed to an active one. You are right 100%. I'm sure that's why they're doing it, because they already have people who are working on their social media, you know, on their social media team. And it's like, why do we need to maintain these sites when we can just, hey, check out our Twitter. You can at reply us, or hey, check out our Facebook page. You can respond or like or whatever. That's just the nature of the beast at this point. To me, like I just get excited because I'm like, maybe something's going to be announced in May, but it's probably, you know, it's not, that's what's not what's going to happen, but
probably not. Yeah.
No, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it. Like I'm not active on the boards because I don't have time. You know, I'm always producing content. I'm producing shows for everyone here on Trek FM for all of our listeners. And I really don't have time to get on boards. If I did, now I used to be very active on discussion boards back, way back, Star Trek Continuum on the Microsoft network in the mid-90s especially. And so I know what it's like, and I understand why people enjoy getting on discussion boards. And I'm afraid that those people may miss the level of interaction with others who love Star Trek that they get there. It's sort of this tug of war between you bringing people to you or you going to where the people are. And so by going to social media, that's CBS's way of going to where the people already are and sharing with them there, versus the challenge of bringing people to you. Because today, even if people are interested in Star Trek and they're interested in the fan galleries and they're interested in the discussion boards, it is sort of an extra step for people to go and create a new account on StarTrek.com and make sure that that's where they go to have their discussions. So I think some people will love this change, and I think some people will be upset by it. I'm interested, to see what the fan reaction is going to be like.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's what it is. This is the nature of change, you know, and things are moving forward. And, you know, you're right. Absolutely right. You know, boards and these things, these are artifacts of the late 90s and the early 2000s. And generally speaking, people don't go to these kinds of, things to interact with other people. It's much more about social media. It's much more about connect to my Facebook or my Twitter or my whatever it is. So, I mean, I guess it makes sense, you know, from CBS's perspective. It makes total sense to do this.
Yeah, it does. But there are values in boards, like I said, in the way that you're able to actually organize topics and conversations. So there's no perfect solution to this. So we'll see how it goes. They are actually going to be locking them on April 28th. So just in 2 weeks, because we're recording this on April 14th. And they will remain available for you to view until May 28th. And then at that point, they're actually going to be removing them from the website completely. So April 28th to May 28th is like a read-only state for you with the fan galleries and the discussion boards. And then they will truly disappear on May 28th.
Did you hear that, Internet Archive? Pay attention, because you got to save all that stuff for later on.
That's right. Save it all. All right. We have one last story in news today, Daniel. And this is one that you were telling me that you've done a little research into. So I'm curious to know what you think about it. A developer called Disruptor Beam is developing a game called Star Trek Timelines, which will bring strategy role-playing to mobile devices. Great news for fans. This is going to be on iOS, Android, and in web browsers. So you're not going to be locked into just iOS, which often happens, which is fine for me because I'm an iOS guy, but I know a lot of people want to have this stuff on Android as well. And it's great for it to be everywhere. What did you find out about this game, Daniel?
Yeah, it is great for you, Chris, who is an iOS guy. I'm an Android guy, so I missed out on the Rivals,
Trexels probably as well.
Yeah. Trexels, like, we miss out on a lot of this stuff. Come on, people, it's not that hard to, you know, cross-platform this. So I did a little bit of research on this, and it was really interesting because what I saw from the original release was that there's going to be, it was funny, they said you can play as or interact with Captain Kirk and Picard or Spock and Data. And I'm like, wait a minute, how does this work? So, you know, I went into it, and what they said was temporal anomalies, mirror universes, and time travel have been a reoccurring themes throughout the Star Trek series and several of the films. This will form the basis of Star Trek Timelines and give us the opportunity to explore a lot of what-if scenarios. What if Spock and Jean-Luc Picard got to serve on the same ship? What would it be like to have members of the Mirror Universe's Terran Empire on your crew? Oh my goodness, Chris, this blew my mind. I got so excited about this. Spock and Picard, like Spock as number one. I don't even know how to say in full sentences how excited this kind of concept makes me. This is so cool.
That does sound cool. It reminds me of these comics that we did on Literary Treks. And they were comics about Trelane and Q, and they were playing a chess match with each other. And what they did is they flipped Kirk and Picard. And so Picard ended up on the original Enterprise, and Kirk ended up on the D. And it was funny to see how their command style meshed with those different crews. So it's kind of like that, it sounds like, and that could be really fun.
I would love to see that, because that would, I'm trying to imagine Kirk on the D, and I just can't see him sitting in the ready room with Livingston. And I just, you know, he would just want to get out there, and Riker would be like, you're not going down to the planet. And Kirk would just, you know, double fist punch overhead Riker, and it would just be, you know, the universe would implode. I don't know what would happen. That would be crazy.
Well, it does sound like an interesting game, and they say that it has an emphasis on rich graphics and a conflict mechanic where science and diplomacy are just as important as combat. That part I'm glad to hear, because when you think of Star Trek Online, you typically think of the starship combat, because that's a big part of the game, but they did eventually introduce diplomatic missions as well, which I think are critical to any Star Trek role-playing game. Because I don't want to speak for everyone, but I feel like a majority of Star Trek fans love Star Trek because of the diplomatic elements of it. You know, the fact it's about a future where we are more open-minded and understanding. And so diplomacy has to be a part of anything Star Trek. And I don't like it when I see games. You see these things sometimes for consoles. Like there was, what's it called? I can't remember the name of it, but they did one for PlayStation 2, which was really just a combat simulator. And they also did one, I think, before the 2009 film for iOS as well, that was really like a combat game.
Yeah, you know, as anybody that follows me on Twitter knows, I'm a huge gamer, so I can talk pretty extensively on this subject. I won't, because that's not the point of this the news here, but it's, you're right. Star Trek doesn't lend itself super easily to video game adaptations like Star Wars does. Something mm-hmm. like Star Wars, where it's like, of course, you can just have a combat simulator or even a third-person shooter or whatever. Like, you can't, it's not all about fighting with Star Trek. Star Trek goes deeper than that. So even Star Trek Online, like there are things that it does right, but we haven't hit the sweet spot yet where Star Trek video games have really kind of hit that right in the middle where it's like, you know, combat is great, but also avoiding combat, or not avoiding it, but diplomacy and all of these other options are the scientific way is just as good. So I hope maybe that this will fill that gap. I think I'm excited about it, at least, because it sounds like it'll at least present us some interesting scenarios.
Definitely. And I'm definitely looking forward to it as well, because I've been looking for a new Star Trek game to play on my iPad. And the ones that we have right now are interesting, but they haven't engaged me sufficiently. And this one actually sounds right up my alley. So I'm looking forward to it. Now, there's no release date announced right now, so we don't know how soon it will be coming. It's not the first foray into this type of game for Disruptor Beam. They actually developed the Game of Thrones Ascent game in 2013, which is based on the HBO series, and it was an award-winning game. So I have high hopes for what we're going to get here with Star Trek. And John Radoff, who is the CEO of Disruptor Beam, explained a little bit about why he wanted to do a Star Trek game. And he said, "We want to create a new generation of strategy game for tablet and mobile devices, and one that is as large and deep as the Star Trek universe itself. I grew up watching the franchise and have always felt that the best episodes were those that went beyond the coolness of the technology or vastness of space, the ones which told the story of characters making important decisions that had an impact on others, on civilizations, planets, and technologies." And that also goes to the point that they say that this game will be dialogue-driven, have great storytelling, and character development as key components. So looking forward to this. Again, it's going to be on iOS, Android, and in web browsers, and hopefully we'll have more news on it soon. Well, Daniel, that's all we have in news, but before we jump over to the town of Tombstone, Arizona, for our feature today, we're going to be joined by Drew and Mariel. We'd like to tell everyone about our sponsor for today's show, and that's Audible.com, the best source for audiobooks that you'll find anywhere. Over 150,000 titles are waiting for you right now. They add hundreds of new titles every single week, and they have new releases, bestsellers, they have comedy, history, science, also lots of Star Trek books, like Prime Directive Federation and Spock's World, which are three of my favorites. They also have a lot of TNG books as well, and every week we like to recommend a book for you, because as a Trek FM listener, you can get one audiobook absolutely free just for trying Audible. Now, Daniel, you're our TNG guy from Earl Grey. We were talking about some of the TNG books that they do have on Audible. What would you like to recommend today?
You know, this past week on Earl Grey with my co-host, we were talking about early TNG, and in Encounter Farpoint, one of the first scenes we get between Troy and Riker, they obviously hint at a huge backstory that, you know, and so there's a novel called M'Zadi, which is actually written by Peter David and narrated by Jonathan Frakes, William T. Riker himself. So this is huge. Like, this is something great that you can check out on audible.com. So this kind of Imzadi, this novel fills out their backstory and also gives a little bit, you know, in their future, like what's going to happen? What would Riker do? Oh, I don't want to spoil anything about the novel, but you know what, you know, in extreme circumstances, how far does this relationship go? So it's really interesting. And it's one of the great novels that you can check out on Audible.
Definitely. And they also have the sequel to this book, Imzadi 2, as well on Audible. And Peter David writes great Star Trek novels. If you've never read any of Peter David's work, you definitely should. And a great way to do that is getting the audiobook format here. This one is narrated by Jonathan Frakes, which, you know, who else would narrate a book about his Imzadi but Jonathan Frakes? And, you know, the one thing that this book is probably missing would be a commentary track with Jonathan Frakes and Marina Sirtis talking about the book, right?
I'm sure they would love to do it.
Because, that would be awesome.
You know, they're great friends, yeah.
So no commentary track, but the book itself is there waiting for you. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get, as I said, a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. And the way you do that is to go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up and then choose Imzadi or any other book you want. And if at the end of the trial period you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep this book. But by supporting Audible and trying out these audiobooks, you'll be helping us keep the Ready Room coming to you every week. So don't miss out on it. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we really thank Audible for their support of the Ready Room and the network. The date is October 26th, 1881. The place is Tombstone, Arizona. No, wait, this is a Star Trek episode. No, it's both. It's the day of the gunfight at the OK Corral. It's also the third season of TOS, and today I'm gathered with an alliance of fellow creatures to discuss TOS's strip of the Wild Wild West, Spectre of the Gun. And those fellow creatures include Trek FM News editor Mariel Kieran. Hello, Mariel.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you back. It's been quite a long time since you've been on the show.
Yeah, I've probably forgotten how to do this.
Well, we will see how it goes. Well, helping you out, of course, will be our co-host from our TOS show, Standard Orbit. The voice behind the curtain, it's Landru. Landru, welcome back.
Joy to you, partners.
Oh, we're partners today. All right, this is part of the alliance of fellow creatures that Kirk spoke of. All right. Well, we're here to talk about Spectre of the Gun. For those who have not seen this episode or have not seen it in a long time, this is the third season TOS episode in which the crew are transported to the Wild Wild West, Tombstone, Arizona, to the day of the shootout at the OK Corral.
But they're not,
as we'll discuss as we go along. And the story's pretty simple. They have to get out of town by 5 o'clock or they're going to be shot dead. And they can't get out of town because there's a force field at the city limits, which if I think about it, I think there are a lot of neighboring towns in America that would like to have force fields between one another, right?
It's true.
The town I grew up in certainly would have loved to have had one. with the neighboring town.
The one thing I know that we're not going to jump right in here, but I have to say, you know, I was thinking when Kirk and I think Spock was there, maybe someone else, when they were standing at the sign that says Tombstone, and he couldn't mm-hmm. move anywhere past the sign. I thought it would have been a really brilliant move if Kirk just picked up the sign and moved it right behind him. So now he's no longer technically in Tombstone.
That would be like the Looney Tunes solution to the situation, right?
Exactly.
I love it.
That would have been awesome. All right. Well, let's just jump into this episode. And Mariel, you chose the episode today. You've been wanting to do Spectre of the Gun for a while. So before we jump into all the different topics we're going to talk about, tell us why you love this episode.
I just think it's a fascinating episode about the power of the mind. I mean, they believe it's real. That makes it real. Even though there's only, you know, fronts on the stores and the sheriff and there's no walls, they still believe it's real for some reason. And it's a good episode to show the power of the mind, like I said. So
yeah,
that's it.
Well, you pointed out the lack of walls. I think it's also a great episode to show the power of the lack of budget. It's a great study in the budget. For sure. But it is a fun episode.
Yeah, I'm interested how much of that was budgetary and how much of it was story-wise. Like, it'll be an interesting story when we get there in Cushman's books.
Oh, I completely think it was for the story.
You think it's completely for the story?
I completely think it was for the story, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it was... Initially, we'll talk about it when we get to that section of the discussion here, but they do mention that it was an attempt to save money because they didn't have a big budget, of course, on season 3. I think it was initially a case of the budget and then a clever way of making it fit into the story. And so it all comes together. Well, Landrew, you're our Standard Orbit guy. So the first topic that we have on the outline is... that this is a wagon train to the stars, literally, because Star Trek was set up. It was pitched kind of like a Western in space, because at the time in the 60s, Westerns were all the rage. And here it literally is a wagon train to the stars, because they're in the Wild Wild West.
Yeah, it's there's something to be said. Take or leave the episode, take or leave the third season. You can't, there's no way that you can miss out on Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and Scotty, and Chekhov with, like, full belts with six shooters and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks great with the uniform and everything. I think that more people should cosplay as people in Spectre of the Gun just so they can carry around six shooters and look awesome like that.
Maybe this episode is the inception. It's the basis. It is the inspiration for Firefly, right?
Oh, even better.
Oh, could be, right. Yeah.
Maybe that's why sense. I like it so much. The visual aspect of mashing science fiction and the Western together. I also appreciate that the sheriff sign on the facade is written in the TOS font. And I think the E is curved, so my little OCD there is satisfied.
My favorite sign is probably teeth pulling by appointment.
The one that's just hanging in the air next to Doc Holliday.
Yeah.
It's not the only thing. I think there's also a painting. I don't know if it's in the bar or what, but there's a painting that's just also kind of suspended.
I think that's the one in the bar. Yeah.
Yeah. But the teeth pulling by appointment, I can't tell if it's outside the wall or if it's hanging on the wall inside, because it wouldn't be very helpful inside. You're already in there. I mean, I guess I need an appointment. Sorry. And then you turn around and walk out.
McCoy didn't need an appointment. He just walked in there and started rummaging around.
I know. He's just knocking stuff over. Damn medievalism here.
I do love how that guy had just the dramatic towel. I don't know if this is like, I don't know anything about the West or Western times, but I don't know if it's like a practice to place a conveniently placed cloth over someone's face, a dramatically placed cloth, so you don't know who they are until they stand up. but I do love that. And he stands up and he's like, I'm the dentist. And it's like, whoa.
Yeah, but it's not like we would have recognized him anyway.
I know.
We don't know what these people look like. Neither did McCoy. It's not...
But that's my point. Then why did they bother to put a towel over his face? And then when he removed it, they act like it was like a big deal, like a big reveal, like, I'm Doc Holliday. Like, oh my goodness. But well, whatever.
Well, if you know the story of the OK Corral, then when he says I'm Doc Holliday, then you would get that. But it's hard to tell. Like you said, he's the dentist, but you wouldn't know because they all look pretty much the same. You know, they're all dressed the same. They all have the mustache, the same look. Like, I'm the lawyer. I'm the baker. I'm the dentist. But then they all come out to shoot you at 5 o'clock.
I also like, I think that's something that they don't do. I mean, they do now, like, you know, in a post Deadwood and Tombstone world. But I think a lot of the traditional Westerns, everyone's super attractive. And I kind of appreciate that the Earps are all, I'm not going to say ugly, but just not, you know, Val Kilmer.
Not attractive. It's okay to say that. That's PC, right?
They had bad teeth. I mean, this is a reality that they would have had in 1811 or whatever year it is. Yeah.
They're not the Sportsmaster, Drew.
Exactly. They can't be good at every sport for some reason.
Including gunfighting. Which, I have to think if the Olympics had been revived in the 1800s, gunfighting would have been an Olympic event.
Oh, yeah. Quick draw. I got a silver medal in quick draw. How'd you get a silver medal? Wouldn't you just have died?
He hit me in the leg.
Oh, well, Daniel, Mariel told me that you love this episode as well. What is it about this episode that really connects with you?
It's weird. You know, I don't know if I would, love is a strong word, but I don't know. There's something about it that draws me to it. And like the ridiculousness of like it in a way, and I'm sure that she likes it in a different reason than I do, but in a way it's kind of calling to the forefront, like how cheesy everything is that we're, you know, that we're used to, you know, accustomed to, like the red backdrop and this just fake planet. And I appreciate the fact that it's, you know, okay. So we go to the Chicago planets and, you know, we go to these Earth planets and it's like, how many ways can you come up? We go to, you know, pre-World
Nazi
War II planet. Yeah. No, so it's like, this is what, you know, TOS does. And it's like, how many ways can you cleverly come up with contrivances to create these circumstances? And this one is one of those where it's like, I buy it. Like, I buy it from the start to the finish because it's a fun ride. I really actually enjoy it a lot.
How do you see this episode compared to the other Old West episodes in Star Trek? So Enterprise did North Star. And then, of course, TNG did A Fistful of Data's. And with you being the Earl Grey guy, how do you see any similarities? Like, I think it's common to think that A Fistful of Data's was inspired by Spectre of the Gun and North Star was inspired by Spectre of the Gun. But really, I think neither one of them were. But do you see connections there?
Maybe only thematically, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, A Fistful of Data's is silly. I mean, I guess this is kind of silly too, but A Fistful of Data's has Troy trying to do a secondary accent while she's, yeah, it's just, yeah, it's
what?
Not a bad,
oh.
Yeah, she tries to do a Marina Sirtis doing Troy doing a Western accent. And it's really it's not effective. It's not
exactly is a Western accent.
Well,
it?
You know, like a, you know,
like
I'm not going to do
West
it. I'm not
cowboy accent.
Yeah, you know.
Come on, Dan. Yeah. Do Dan Come doing on, Ryan Curtis doing Troy doing a Western.
I don't think I could do it. Look, it, all you,
Come
all
on,
you
Daniel. I promise it will not become a sound clip that's used on all of our other shows. I promise.
All you would have to do is watch that episode and listen to Data Talk, because Brent Spiner does a pretty hilarious Western accent. So, you know what? It's different. It's different. I didn't care for North Star, and A Fistful of Datas is fun, but kind of forgettable, especially because Alexander's in it. Oh, God, I hate Alexander. But this one is, you know, it's the only time of those three episodes where they blend the Western elements, and I actually really enjoy it. I had a lot of fun with it.
Well, let's go on to another topic here. And Mariel, this will come around to something that you were talking about in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
And it's the fact that this is a figment of your imagination, and that what they think is real is not necessarily real. And that ends up being sort of the cornerstone of the story and to the solution. And I think this episode is an interesting mix of stylistic expression, philosophical debate, and lack of money. And all of those play into the idea that it's a figment of your imagination. But let's talk about the philosophical side for a minute, because that's what you were mentioning as we were talking before the show.
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, it's a great piece of postmodern literature, really. It exemplifies the genre, because everything is symbolized by something. And so you start to question the truth of reality. And I think that's what we're really seeing there. I mean, they go in and they just automatically assume they're in the past, assume they're on Earth. I just did not get that, because Kirk, he throws in the line when he's talking to the bartender about, you know, who do you think I am? And he's trying to explain. He says, we're not even born yet. Like, he is just buying it hook, line, and sinker. Yeah. And he's not anywhere near Earth. I did not understand that. But I just think it's a great episode to exemplify the postmodern literature genre, because, as I said before, I think the facades, okay, fine, there was a budget problem, but it's so minimal that, and yet they're taking it as real. It's a symbol, but to them, it's real.
Yeah, it is odd that they would see the buildings and see that there's just a wall there. And Kirk does make the comment that maybe this is all they need in order to make their point and to carry out their plan. So there are times where, like, I get the impression that the crew, they understand that this isn't Earth, but they think it's real at some point. It's hard to say whether they think that it's completely a fabricated environment, because if they did think that, it seems like it wouldn't take them so long to figure out that, you know, the bullets weren't real, and that it's just, if they believe it, then it's real. But they've been in these situations before. But maybe, Daniel, like you were saying, they've encountered, you know, the Chicago planet and the Roman amphitheater planet and the parallel planet where all the adults are dead, but everything else is exactly the same as Earth. And so maybe they'd feel like, okay, well, I guess maybe somehow they've recreated Earth here again. Like, this is a real world, a real planet, just happens to look like Earth. And so they don't really question that at first.
And I just love the fact that they're so quick to jump to conclusions. Like, the guy gets shot in front of them and they're like, death is the only thing that's real on this planet. And they're like, wait a minute. How do you know that? That could just be a total figment of your imagination as well. They're just like, that's the only thing real here. And I'm just like, okay, I guess.
Which you would think Chekhov would have said, no, no, the ladies are real too.
Exactly.
He was busy.
Landru does the okay sign to the camera, right?
They are real girls. I just got frustrated watching this episode again, because I don't know if it's we've seen the episode or we live in like a I'm going to use post lot, a post matrix world where, you know, oh, things aren't as they seem. We understand. We get it. But it just gets, it just gets frustrating how long it takes them to come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
And it's only in like the last 5 minutes they're like, oh, if we believe the bullets won't kill us, they won't. Oh, okay. The end. And I hate how it ends with, it's an arena ending. It's like, oh, you didn't kill him. You're a cool dude. It's like, what? That was it? But it wasn't a test. They were being punished. But because they didn't kill, even though they were supposed to die, means, okay, cool. Federation's awesome. But it wasn't a test. Like, arena was a test. And I don't know.
No, it makes total sense. They, you know, they send out this probe, and then to punish them, they send them to this planet, and somehow they succeed through the non-test, and then the probe explodes, and then now they're all friends. I don't, Drew, what don't you understand about this plot? This makes total sense to me.
And then they go to the planet. They set course for the planet, which, interestingly, is the only episode of the original series where the Enterprise heads to a planet at the end of the story, which
instead of
know,
going away,
kind of surprising to me. The probe was interesting, though. It was kind of like a, at least in the remastered, it's like a space disco ball.
Oh yeah, it's very groovy, baby.
Okay, I'm going to bring this up now because I don't know when would be more appropriate than this, but these aliens are really, first of all, their face things are creepy and scary and interesting. Like, I really like them. And second of all, at the end of the episode, we're kind of led to believe that they're interested, at least, in joining the Federation. And if they did, I would think they would be helpful against the Borg or the Dominion or something. Like, they would be really powerful allies to have, but we never, ever hear from them again.
You would think, because they appear to be made of stone or something, like, they could hide. And then when the Jem'Hadar came in, they could all just fall off on top of the Jem'Hadar and crush them.
They could spew out fog into the cave so nobody would see their glowing eyes.
We will make it difficult for them to see you. So the other races in the Federation, they can all, you know, carry out the assault while these guys just make it hard for the enemy to see.
Well, in that one battle in Deep Space Nine, the one where they go on that planet, it was kind of foggy on that planet.
Maybe they were there.
Siege of AR-300 and whatever. Maybe they were there.
The Melkatonins
were there, blowing smoke everywhere.
So you're blaming this race on the loss of Nog's leg. Way to go!
Yes,
you're saying it's their fault.
All right. Well, you know, speaking of the probe/space buoy disco ball here, who was the voice of the space probe?
Well, if it was the voice of something, so it's probably Jimmy Doohan.
It was James Doohan. His pre-TAS days of doing more voices.
Of doing every voice.
On the show, yeah. So the probe was, it was kind of interesting though. It also reminded me, especially when we get to the end of the episode, where apparently they never left the bridge. Like, they were on the bridge the whole time and they didn't really go anywhere. It's a lot like the Inner Light also. Daniel, of course, right? Where there's kind of a space probe and it does something and then they think they're somewhere else and then they wake up on the bridge. And it also speaks, it's like telepathic, but you hear it in your native language, which is how we know once again that Uhura's native language is Swahili. I think it's the third time in the series where we find that out. And it reminded me of the Inner Light there as well, but also reminded me of like an Errand of Mercy, where you have the Organians and they're able to sort of project themselves places and speak on all these different planets, which would also mean that they're being heard in the native languages of those planets as well. So we've got a lot of different TOS themes rolled up into one here.
I like the idea of the Inner Light being a remake of Spectre of the Gun. Huh.
The problem, I think, if we're going to compare the Inner Light and I mean, even without doing that, but what happens at the end of the episode when they just show up on the bridge, throughout the rest of the episode, we get this amazing new feature in Star Trek of transportation by Zoom, That's what they do.
Oh yeah. I call it transportation by coat sleeve because you zoom into the arm and back out and you teleport.
And like at first, like in the beginning of the episode, I'm like, okay, I can buy into it. But then at the end of the episode, Chekhov's like at his station and he's like, where have I been the whole time? And it's like, that was kind of German. I know that's not Chekhov, but, but it's like, this is like the most jarring transition between the rest of the episode and the ending of it than I've ever seen. Like they didn't even try to come up with a reasonable way to do it. It's just like Kirk's like, I guess we were here the whole time. It's like, oh, all right.
Well, we just won't go to the OK Corral. Zoom. You're in the OK Corral. See, that's cheating.
I love it. It's so ridiculous.
I wanted to point out that the whole reason that they're in the past is because they needed to be punished. And so they scanned Kirk's mind for the punishment. And somehow Tombstone came up, which was like 400 years before. It would be like us thinking of King James the First. And then, you know, oh, now suddenly we're in King James I. But it reminded me of Ghostbusters when Gozer has them choose the Destructor.
What did you do, Rafe? Jim? What did you think of, Jim?
Did you do, Jim? I tried to think.
Maybe Kirk was thinking of Where No Man Has Gone Before, and he was thinking of his James R. Kirk Tombstone, and these aliens mistook Tombstone for Tombstone, Arizona. And that's why they end up there. Now, if they had mistaken it for Tombstone Pizza, then they would have been like at a Chuck E. Cheese and it would have been...
The animatronics would come to life more. And kill
yes, them. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Spectre that's of the Rat.
In terms of the buildings, though, like the budgetary thing, I think that we asked at the beginning, Mario, you said you think it was completely for the story. And...
Sure, why not?
Well, see, I think that...
I really do, though. I mean, I know they had budget problems, but it just fits with the whole... It's not real, but they're taking it as real when you can clearly see there's no building there. It bugs me, sorry.
Well, the original idea for the episode was that they would actually go to a Western town and shoot the episode there. So there would have actually been buildings... But, you know, they didn't have the budget to go do that, so they had to shoot on the sound stages. And, of course, they didn't want to build a whole Western town set on the sound stages. And so how can you do that? How can you save money, get it on the sound stage? Let's just put up one wall of the building. And so I think from there, then creatively, you want to figure out a way to make this work within the story so it's not just... Like, hey, we have no money. Let's just throw together whatever we can find from another TV show. You know, it's not Galactica 1980 that we're shooting here. It's Star Trek. And so from there, I think they get into what you talk about, Mariel, where they did find a way to work it into the story where it did make sense and it was stylistic and it did sort of create the idea. It supported the story or the story was written to support the set. That should have tipped them off that this is part of our imagination here. That's why we're not seeing everything. So they did work it into the story and it supports the idea.
I think that episode would have worked a lot better with it being, if it was in an old West town, like one of those
having all the buildings,
Western sets. I think it would be more believable for them to maybe think that they had traveled back in time or that things were real. But as it stands, you know, when the lightning strikes and you can see the reflection, the shadows of the trees against the sky, you know, really big because it's just a backdrop. It's like they made no problem with saying this is a backdrop. The Earps are just walking in front of a you know, a white sheet and we shine a red light on.
I'm surprised. I actually am. I to hear you say that you would prefer that it was against an actual town, like, would that make it more believable? I don't know. To me, not at all. Like, I get the sense that what they're trying to portray is that these aliens are super powerful telepaths. And so it doesn't bother me that, like, and it's kind of a throwaway line when they say, oh, Kirk doesn't know everything about Tombstone, Arizona. he doesn't know everything, so they just leave the gaps empty instead of automatically filling them. Although, to be fair, if they're really smart, you would think that they could kind of construct walls, but whatever.
If you're a telepath, have you ever built a building?
But it's just like, to me, it's just like, no, it doesn't bother me at all. I think it was probably completely budgetarily influenced, and that's why they did it, but I actually really appreciate it for that. I think that they made a really interesting and creative choice with how they portrayed the town and stuff. Like, if we had seen a regular Western town that had been used in other films or whatever, then it would have been it would have been par for the course. It would have just been regular, but this is something that we'd never see anytime. And it's really, for that reason alone, I think it's at least interesting to watch.
I don't think it would have worked if it was in a regular town. Like, I think that's part of the point, is that it's in their mind, you know, at the end when they're doing the whole mind meld and the bullets aren't real. I mean, that's the point. I mean, that's the title of the episode, Spectre of the Gun. I mean, I don't think it would have worked if everything was real.
Yeah. Now, the original title of the episode was The Last Gunfight. And that's actually the title that James Blish used in the novelizations that he did of all the TOS episodes. In that respect, yeah, maybe. But yeah, like you say, Mariel, it is Spectre of the Gun. So in this case, it does make more sense. I'm sort of in between. I think it depends on what they're trying to get at with the story. So like Drew's saying, if the buildings had all been real, for the crew, it would have been more believable that they had been transported somewhere and that everything was real and it was truly a life or death situation for them. But if the point of the story is that reality is what we make it, if we believe something is true or real, then it's true or real, even if it isn't, this sort of facade that they've created supports that idea a little bit better as well. Although I still think that they should have been tipped off a little bit sooner, because if it weren't for Spock, I'm not sure that they would have ever figured this out. Do you think Kirk and Bones and Chekhov, who was already dead at that point, Scotty just wanted some bourbon, half gallon of bourbon. So
anything's better than corn whiskey. So
yes, okay. Yeah, corn whiskey is awesome.
I love the look on his face when they... He was offered the corn whiskey.
Scotty is Scotty is like on point this episode. I feel like he was he was just exactly how I expected Scotty to be. He's like, you need a volunteer for this crazy drug you're about to do? All right, I'll do it. And then he just like inhales all the smoke that's coming out of this grenade, and he's just like, yeah, I'm good for it.
Yeah, I like that. It took Chekhov dying. And Scotty not passing out from a smoke bomb in order for them to be like, you know what? Things are a little weird around here. And it's just McCoy's insistence that, no, I made it totally right. This should work. It's like, but how do you know? I mean,
it's not just McCoy's insistence. It's McCoy and Spock working together.
This is true. Yeah. And that's the real sign that something's wrong. Is that they agreed on something. McCoy was a little,
wasn't sure on that one.
Spock was funny in this episode. He was zinging people. Did you notice?
Oh yeah. Like
he got Scotty. He's like, unlike Mr. Scott's transporter, this device is not functioning. And like sarcasm from Spock. All right. And then he really zings Bones later when McCoy says, I doubt that this combination of things was ever used for any purpose quite like this. And Spock says, perhaps they would have been if they'd had your ingenuity, Doctor. And I just felt him like zing.
Did you feel like that was an insult? I actually kind of thought that it was a compliment.
I thought it was sarcasm.
I say that because of Bones' reaction to it. He's like, okay, well, all right, I say, all right.
I'll allow it.
Yeah, I'll have to say I kind of took it as a compliment.
I thought he was like kind of maybe like an underhanded compliment, but I actually didn't see it as sarcastic at all. I thought he was actually giving him a genuine good job. I never would have thought of this, or most people have never thought of this.
I thought it was Spock's sense of humor evolving a little bit, and that he was kind of jabbing Bones, but Bones didn't get it because he wasn't used to Spock doing that in the first place. You know, Vulcan humor is very subtle.
Yeah, McCoy wasn't around for the stone knives and bear skins comment in City on the Edge.
It's interesting in Enterprise as well to watch T'Pol's sense of humor and the way that she makes sarcastic comments, and you see Archer kind of learn when she's being serious and when she's making sarcastic comments. So it seems to be a Vulcan trait. All right. Well, one more thing here, talking about bullets, is that I think this might be the origin of the famous quote, "Without the safeties, even real bullets can kill." Because as you pointed out, Daniel, this could be the prelude to holodeck malfunctions.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a way it is. It does kind of have the feel of a holodeck episode where we're brought to a ridiculous place that there's not a real world explanation for why we would be there, and then something has to go wrong for there to be danger. You know, they have that whole conversation, which is a prelude to the holodeck safety conversation, where they're like, "This is crude, but if you're close enough, it could be just as dangerous as a phaser." And you're like, "Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I would think bullets would be pretty dangerous." Maybe they were playing around with this idea early on. I don't know. It probably wasn't, you know, a direct descendant, but at least you can see where they kind of picked this up and moved it forward.
Well, what do you think, Landru? Because, you know, they did have this idea of a holodeck in the original series. It's something they couldn't really do. And we did finally get it in the animated series. But there's that kind of thought process there, maybe. And I do wonder if they could have done the holodeck on the original series, if we would have gotten more episodes like this. And that would have been maybe a more plausible reason for them than, "Hey, look, all these planets are Earth parallels."
Yeah. people give the holodeck malfunctions a lot of crap, but it's a great way to get off the ship without getting off the ship. Like, it would make sense for Kirk and Spock and everybody to know about as much about Tombstone, Arizona as they do. I mean, cause Spock's like, just like, "Oh, you know," quoting all these things, and at exactly 5 o'clock, everybody died at the OK Corral. And it's like us remembering stuff from the 1600s. It's just not something that normally happens.
Okay, good. I misunderstood you there. I thought you said it made sense. And I was going to say, I don't know. They seem to know way too much about this old historical
thing.
But
if it was,
that's what
if
you
it
mean,
was,
yeah.
Let's go to, you know, Kirk made a holodeck program. We're all playing on it. And the Malkoshians think that it's reality on it. Right. And because they were studying it or preparing a play or something Next Generation EE about it, it would make sense. But I'm afraid of what TOS would do with a holodeck.
For example.
Because you look at all the terrible things that TNG ended up doing, like, or Voyager.
We're not going to talk about Fairhaven. We're not going to talk about the Irish Village. We're not going to talk about Leonardo da Vinci's studio.
Right. But those weren't even malfunctions. Well, partly some of them. But I'm afraid that in TOS, you know, had season 4 picked up and they'd put in a holodeck, we would get a lot of, "Well, you know, I'm going to travel, you know, we're just going to visit the 60s again, because why not? And, you know, we're just going to study them in the holodeck because it's less dangerous." And then it becomes dangerous. I can see them playing with that too much.
I feel like it didn't stop them, though. Like, the fact that they didn't have this convenience plot device is not like, "Oh, we just traveled back into the 60s to stop this launch," and, like, they just did it anyways. This was like, there's no plot.
Well, yeah. So that was when they had to come up with excuses. If they didn't have to come up with excuses, they'd use it all the time. The whole series would be, "What's going on in the holodeck today?"
Also, are you saying, Drew, and just out of curiosity, as the TOS guy on the network, are you saying that you don't buy the fact that Spock prides himself on his Earth history? It's stated very clearly in this
writing. I throw the BS flag at that. where everybody can see it, because that line made me roll my eyes. It's like, wait, what? Why would you? Okay, I guess he's half human, and I guess he's super smart, and I know that he knows everything about Vulcan history, but Earth history, we get the impression that Vulcan history is very singular. You know, we had Surak, and then we had, you know, T'Pol and things like that. Everybody united. But like Earth history, we've got the Old West, and we've got, you know, colonial America, and we've got, you know, ancient Egyptians. And what were the Egyptians doing during the Old West? I mean, what if they got thrown then and thrown back there? And well, they weren't thrown anywhere. But what if, I don't know.
Well, they all got carried through the Stargate, Drew. So
this is, you know, true.
They weren't available for shootouts at the OK Corral.
That would have been crazy.
You know that core curriculum on Vulcan, everyone has to take Savagery 101 and 102, which is actually Earth history. That's how they know so much about it.
Okay. The Old West was a bad time for people in Earth. For the 400 people who lived in the Old West, most of them died.
I will say about the way this is shot, though, like merging the Old West, it is something you have to remember, that you have to kind of make yourself remember that at the time this was shot, Westerns were really big on television. So you turn the channel and you're going to see Westerns all the time on your TV. And so how do you take that and put it into Star Trek and make it feel different? And it is where the lighting, even the wind, and where I think that the choice to make the sets single walls instead of full buildings and all really helped to give, because a lot of these actors, they were starring in Westerns at the time. I mean, even DeForest Kelly, you know, DeForest Kelly, in fact, had actually played these characters before in actual Westerns. And how do you make it feel like Star Trek? And I think they pulled that off pretty well in here. It feels artificial. It feels like, yeah, this is something that aliens are creating in space somewhere.
Don't get me wrong. I love the minimal sets and the red sky artistically. And thinking of it like that, like if you're using Bonanza's set and you're going up against Bonanza in the rating, you know, in the time slot, you got to make yourself look different. Which makes me think, like, maybe the red sky was kind of like how the Simpsons are yellow, so that, you know, you're flipping through the channels and your eye is drawn to it because they're bright colors. I'm wondering if that was the same kind of thing. Like, look, it's a Western, but the sky's bright red. Whoa, what's that? And they flip back to it between the three channels that they had back then, I guess.
So they went to Bonanza and they said, can we borrow your set? And they said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll give you the front wall of that building. We'll give you the back wall of that building. We'll give you a sign from this one.
And a bar. That's all you need. A bar and those swinging doors. You're fine.
And we'll give you the sign that says Tombstone City Limits.
Oh, and that's the thing. They kept using the doors.
Oh my God. I'm so glad we brought this up. There is a scene when Chekhov walks through the doors, and then when Chekhov gets shot, Spock and Kirk run around the building and just to see what's going on. We didn't have enough time to run through the doors. We're here to see what's going on. And it's like, why would you ever use doors in this place just where you can walk freely from building to building?
All right. When are we going to talk about the fact that Chekhov buys into this immediately?
Okay. Well, let's
pretty lady involved. Of course he did.
Let's talk about that then. There's a little Russian romance here. I was thinking, like, Chekhov saying, romance was invented by a little old lady from Leningrad. So the studio, apparently, before the third season started shooting, Gene Roddenberry and executives at NBC had exchanged memos about wanting to use Chekhov more in the third season, making him a more prominent character, because he was added in the second season, and of course he had the whole monkeys look to kind of, you know, bring in that demographic, because the monkeys
band. I'm sorry, I was thinking of the Resolution Monkey.
Not the resolution, Lucky. No, no.
Tristan would be band. So happy right now. You know?
The band, the monkeys, you know, so to bring that demographic, and it seemed to help and work a bit. But so they wanted to feature him more prominently. So what did they do with his character? Apparently, they make him like this skirt chaser. He's just like every girl that walks by, he's just can't keep his eyes off of her. And like you said, he buys completely into this because, hey, you know, well, there is a lady here.
Yeah, this pretty girl wants to make out with me. I don't care if she's real or not. I mean, there's no question. You know, McCoy's is like, it's real because this guy's dead. And Chekhov is like, it's real because this chick wants to make out with me.
And, you know, it's, they're all sitting at the table there and having their corn whiskey and bourbon. And I know, you know, TOS has a bit of a, they have the 50 minutes to fill or the 48 minutes to fill instead of the 42 minutes.
52
whatever.
Minutes. In
52 minutes. Yeah, okay. Quite, is that what it is?
It's yeah, quite okay. Long. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes in some episodes, maybe we get a little bit of filler. Well, there's a 3-minute makeout scene with Chekhov and this woman. And
you're
it's
timing it?
Well, I feel like it was 3 minutes. I'm not sure if it was, but it's so long because they're all just staring at it. And it goes like, this is what Kirk's reaction to Chekhov making out with this girl is. This is what Spock's reaction is. This is what Scotty's reaction is. And this is what, you know, McCoy's reaction. And it's just like, I cannot even, like, this is the most uncomfortable scene I've ever watched. I'm like, please just stop. Just stop.
It's embarrassing. You're an embarrassing Starfleet officer. What's weird is that Chekhov's skirt chasing has never been a cliche or a meme or anything. You know, we've got, you know, Kirk sleeping with every woman who comes across him and, you know, punching people in the face. But Chekhov was always just like, you know, I'm the Russian guy. Like, why does the JJ Chekhov not chase women? I want to see him chase women around.
He's 17.
The hallways of the Enterprise.
He's too busy shadowing Scotty to learn how to make the engines go. He doesn't have time for ladies.
Poorly.
I want to see him chasing women down the hallway screaming, I can do that. I can do that.
Wow.
I can do her. I can do her.
Oh, man. At least that would make the Carol Marcus scene make sense, right? Like,
yeah. If Chekhov was like peeking in through the window of the shuttlecraft.
Well, I can see after he's running down the hall yelling that, and Spock looks over at Kirk and says, no, he can't. It would be the, in JJ's, it would be Spock who would deliver that line, I think. Yeah, it's, Chekhov is, and the only thing, so they've already established, right, that the guns are dangerous, the bullets are dangerous. If you get shot in here, you're going to die. And still, the only thing Chekhov cares about is this girl, and he's going to take on Earp here. And
he's worried about taking her to a dance next week and stuff.
Right? Like, you just met her like an hour ago.
You're going to die in 2 hours.
Right. You met her an hour ago. You're going to die in 2 hours, but make sure you've got those plans squared away for the dance next week, Chekhov.
You can't marry me. You don't know who I really am. And it's like, what? 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 Why are you talking about being married to someone?
And he's trying to impress her, like, oh, those guys and their outdated weapons, they can't hurt me. Many people have tried to kill me before. Many people. You don't know how many times people have tried to kill me, but I'm still here to make out with you.
And Drew brought up the Matrix, and Chekhov literally mentions stepping out of the way of a bullet. So
right.
Oh.
He's Neo. Yeah.
So the Matrix is also a remake of Spectre of the Gun.
Yes, it is. And in fact, if Kirk and Spock and all of them hadn't resolved the issue soon enough, Chekhov would have stood up, pushed the bullets out of his body, and then been able to kill all the other people by stopping their bullets and just winning. Because he's the one.
I am the one. The Wessel of the Gods.
All right. So Chekhov dies for part of the episode anyway, because he's shot. And that was sort of the thing that tipped them off that something was different here. That plus the fact that their snake venom and shrub bomb did not knock Scotty out. And this comes down to the idea that they were so convinced earlier. We talked about them making assumptions that you can't change history. Like, we've been sent back into the past. This is history. It has to play out as it did. We have to die at 5 o'clock. And then Spock points out that, well, you know, Billy, he didn't die in the original gunfight. He survived. Chekhov's dead now, so maybe we can change history. It's almost like the crew, for a lot of this episode, they don't seem to realize that they have not really traveled to the past.
Yeah, and that's a big problem in that why would they have sent you into the... I mean, I guess there are aliens in other science fiction TV shows that do send you into the past to kill you. They're weeping angels from Doctor Who. But, I mean, they're not sending you in the past to kill you specifically in a specific way in the past. But, yeah, them... thinking, I don't know if they think they're in the past or they're reliving the past. Maybe they're just reliving the past and they've been through this before with some other alien. It's like, oh, we got to relive the past and, you know, else we'd be doomed to repeat it, but we have to repeat it. And yeah, I just don't understand why it takes Chekhov dying for them to be like, maybe things aren't like what we thought here. Like, couldn't you figure that out some other way? And it takes him dying and the smoke bomb not working to convince them. It's like one or the other, guys. But Chekhov dying is... I mean, thankfully, they do have a really good scene. I really like the scene after Chekhov dies and everybody's sitting around in the bar and reminiscing and stuff. I do like that. I think that's one of the highlights of the episode. But just the whole concept of... well, we're in the past and we're going to die at 5 o'clock. So, yep, might as well.
You know, I just, it's amazing. We've been talking and I think, you know, you guys have seen it in a different light than I have. It's like, I don't have a problem with the fact that I don't think they think they're in the past. I just think that they think that the scenario they're in is based on the past. So it doesn't blow my mind that, like, they think that they can't change it because they think that the aliens, the all-powerful aliens that have brought them to this scenario, have laid out events in a way that they cannot alter them. So, I don't think that it's, Chekhov dying to me doesn't make sense, like, why that would be an eye-opener, because why couldn't Chekhov die? Chekhov could totally die.
Billy.
right. But, it makes sense to me that they're not sure after Chekhov dies. Like, they're still a little uncertain exactly what the rules are in this universe. But once chemistry and physics doesn't work the way it should, like Spock says, and then they understand why the rules are different than they should be, that makes sense to me as a reason for them to say, oh, okay. So even though we knew we were in this fictional universe, we knew that we were doing things according to different rules than we're used to. We knew that was happening, but now we understand some of them. At least now we understand that the regular rules don't apply because we would think that they would. So that's not a big hang up for me. Like, I have no problem. Like, they see the fact that there's only one wall in the building that they're in. That I don't think that's the issue. The issue is, like, they don't know what the rules are in the world that they are in this episode.
I wrote down the lines that bothered me. If this is a replay of history, then history cannot be changed. I think is my sticking point there, where they're like, this is the way it happened 400 years ago, so it's going to have to happen like that now. And they just basically give up right there, right at the beginning.
And you would think they would know from The City on the Edge of Forever that history can be changed. I mean, they had to go to great lengths not to change history. Or do you think they're saying, like, it can't be changed because we can't screw with history? But I don't think that's what they're saying here. I think that they feel like they're locked into, like you said, Daniel, the aliens have laid things out that they're going to follow this course and they can't do anything to change it.
Yeah, because do they, I remember that line as well from the episode, but do they say that, like, what part of the episode do they say then? Do they say it
right
after?
At the beginning?
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
That did bother me too. But like, then Kirk tries to go and talk to the sheriff, the crazy sheriff, and they have like an overact competition. Like they're just screaming in each other's faces.
It's so beautiful.
It's amazing.
I like that scene. The other highlight of the episode is them trying to out Ham Shatner and losing.
It was awesome.
Well, him and the bartender also, where he's like, who do you think I am?
Feel my
Who
clothes.
Do you think you
Feel
are?
My clothes.
You know? Feel my clothes.
Yeah, that's really funny.
Feel my
there.
Shirt.
You keep
that's
thinking
a
that.
Weird request, sir.
Right. Come on, feel it. Feel my shirt.
But the bartender doesn't yours. Bat an eye. He's just like, yeah, all right.
Now feel your shirt. Now feel her shirt.
So, Mariel, any thoughts on changing history?
You know, I'm kind of with Daniel in that I'm not totally surprised, but to me, I feel like McCoy could have made the bomb thing, you know, wrong. So I think I understand that there might have been some doubt with that. You know, not every experiment works, not every, you know, whatever. Anyways, but when they point out that Chekhov dies and his character, or whatever you want to call it, didn't, like, that just is, yes, it's definitely, we can change things. So I'm a little bit opposite on Daniel with that.
Now, you said McCoy could have made it wrong, right? Because I thought I heard you say bong, because Scotty, man, he was sniffing that for so long, and then at the end, when they ask him, how do you feel? He's, I feel great. I love this snake venom
smoke. That was the other
thing.
I mean, that guy drinks. Have you seen him drink? I mean, God knows if that thing would have affected him anyway. I mean, and that's the other part. So
the smoke was going everywhere. They all should have passed out.
That was my other thought.
Yeah. Here's a chemical nerve, Spock. He's like, here's a chemical nerve agent. I'm going to open it while I'm standing here, place it on the counter, and then back away slowly. Like, well, it wouldn't affect me.
That's justifiable. And I was thinking this when I was watching episode 2. I'm like, oh gosh, you know, should he be that close to it? And I was like, well, it probably doesn't affect Vulcans.
Oh, I mean, okay.
Yeah, how many episodes is it that everyone's affected by something except for Spock? Because he's Vulcan.
But just like in the Chekhov scene where I feel like they stretched out Chekhov making out with this woman, there's like a 30-second scene of Scotty just inhaling all the smoke.
Just
and I'm
smoke
just like,
coming billowing out all around him.
And it's like you can't even see his face and you can just – he's just like really enjoying his
– I thought that was kind of effective because it had been a long time since I had seen this episode before I watched it to prepare for the show today. And of course, I've seen it many times, but it was a long time ago. And so I didn't remember if that affected Scotty or not. And I was thinking, like, if this is your plan, you guys realize you're going into a shootout, right? You know, you don't have, because they already say it takes like 3 to 4 seconds for it to take effect. And then I'm thinking, like, if this works, we're talking more like 10, 15 seconds. I really don't think, mm-hmm. What are you going to do? Trick them into opening it, have them stare at it for a while before they say draw?
Well, like my dad and I were discussing the other day, like if people have guns pointed at you and like smoke goes off or the lights go out, they don't immediately shoot. They react so that you can, you know, jump kick them in the face. That happened right. On Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And that's what Dad is. It's like, why did they not shoot when the lights went off? And I'm like, because they needed to get punched in the face. I don't know.
Just go with it.
You talk about stretching these things out, though, Daniel, in this scene with Scotty. It's also like in the Galileo 7 where he's got the panel off the wall and he's got the wrench in there and he's jiggling the wrench. That goes on forever. It's another one of those Scotty moments of stretching out the episode. And you're at a point where you're like, all right, Scotty, I think that's not it's good. It's good now. You can stop.
James Doohan must have been really good at improv. So they were always just like, we want to stretch out something, do something crazy for 30 seconds, and we'll just keep the camera rolling.
The thing was, in the scene, like, you can't even tell it's James Doohan. There's so much smoke in front of his face. I was like, I was expecting, like, him to, you know, like, in like a classic TOS way to, like, his face to become disfigured, or maybe for him to change into one of the aliens or something. And it's just like, nope, he's just inhaling all that smoke. He's just having a great old time. I breathe as deeply as I can, Captain. Like, it's like, whatever.
Before we wrap up here, which we'll be wrapping up soon as we're approaching an hour, one thing I did want to mention and get your thoughts on was similarities to later Star Trek episodes. And this, because in TNG, we have Where No One Has Gone Before, where the crew is imagining things as well. I guess Nagilam, right? Daniel's making them have these sort of visions of what's going on. And then on DS9, in If Wishes Were Horses, we also get this thing again where what's going on isn't real. Like, it's our imagination that's making us believe that this is true. And if we believe it's true, then it's real. And as long as we know it's not real, then we're okay. And that's what we get at the end of this episode, where they can just stand there while the bullets fly through them. And although we don't get the great moment in here where you go to yellow alert and Kira says, yellow alert against our own imaginations, which was a great moment. But yeah, there are those similarities to what comes later on in Star Trek as well. So let's wrap up the discussion here and kind of pull all the pieces of this episode together with our final thoughts and our rating. Landry, what are your final thoughts and your rating for this episode?
Spectre of the Gun. It's not the worst season 3 episode, and I wouldn't even say it's a bad episode. It has a good story. It just takes a while in getting there. There's pointless makeout scenes. There's pointless smoke-filled scenes.
Don't forget the clock zoom. I love the clock zoom.
The clock zoom.
Yes.
The clock hanging. The clock that's hanging at the end of town, because they're at the edge of town at 5 o'clock. They look up. There's a clock hanging in space. And then they just zoom to the OK Corral. But I think that the episode does make our heroes look stupid. For too long. They don't know what's going on, which I guess is most episodes of any Star Trek series. They don't understand what's going on until the very end. And then it's like, oh, that was easy. But, the idea of reality not being real is really cool. But I think that it could have come through in a better story. But overall, I'd give it a 6 out of 8 weird rock alien head people.
Very good. Mariel, how about you?
You know, I suggested this episode because I really, really like it. As much as it bothers me, I really don't think that the characters look stupid. I think it works. I like it for that. I think the whole, as you said, you know, the reality not being real, I think that's really cool. And I think the fact that they don't clue into it is what helps make that real for the viewer. Kind of an odd thing to say, I guess, making it real for the viewer when we're talking about reality. Anyways.
Or are we?
But I would give it 9 out of 10 shots of corn whiskey.
Excellent. How about you, Daniel?
I also really enjoyed this episode. I don't know, you know, I don't get to visit TOS as often as the other shows, it seems like. And sorry, Drew.
Was that a hint?
It's fine.
You know, and it's just like every time I go back to it, it's really amazing. I always feel like there's a strength of character, you know, through the main cast in TOS. Like I watched this show and I'm like, you know what? This may be not the most well-received episode of all time, but all of the characters are right on point. Like, you know, Scotty is Scotty because he likes to drink, I guess. But, you know, Spock is Spock because he's smart. He figures it out. And Kirk is Kirk because the enemy is like, this is your only warning. And Kirk's like, don't shoot us. And then he's just like, well, forget about it. We'll just go in anyways because he's Kirk. You know, he doesn't care. And, you know, I like the stylistic choices that were made, whether they were budgetary or not. But I like that it's an interesting way of looking at thought and this telepathic race that we never get to hear of again, unfortunately. But it's, to me, it's a really visually striking episode of the original series. I had a good time watching it, and every time I watch it, I enjoy it. So I'm going to give it 7 flapping toupees, you know, out of 12 or whatever. So, because when Kirk's in that fight scene at the end and they have the wind going full blast, it's just like,
right.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
I love that it ends with him running up and doing the flying kick.
Yes.
Because for all the bar fight scenes that we have in the original series, here's an episode where there's an actual bar in the Old West, and we don't have the full-on Trouble with Tribbles bar fight scene that we would expect that we would get in the Western episode.
Man, if they figured out earlier that they could change history, it's like, let's just have a brawl. It's not real. They treat it like a holodeck and just throw things around.
You know, my wife will not watch the original series, and her impression of the original series, the thing that she remembers most about it when she thinks of TOS is that it has these bar fight scenes throughout the series.
So. She thinks it's full of Andorian fight scenes.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, I enjoy this episode myself, even though I pointed out certain things about it today that might sound otherwise. It's sort of a middle of the road TOS episode for me. What I love about TOS, and well, I grew up with TOS, you know, before TNG was ever around. So it is that series that's nostalgic for me. It's what got me into Star Trek. One thing that I love about it is that it does have these deeper messages in it, like what's the nature of reality and are things real because we believe they're real when maybe they're not? While at the same time, production on a shoestring budget, you know, there's a lot of cheesiness and a lot of corniness in the original series, which if you hold it to the same production standard as later series, maybe that seems like a problem, but actually, for me, that's a lot of the charm of the original series. It's what I love about it. So the fact that they do have what's obviously a soundstage, and it's obviously lights, you know, shining on a backdrop, and it's just one wall of a building here. And even the way that all of the actors who play the Earps and you know, play, well, not the sheriff, but Doc Holliday, you know, come in, the way they portray those roles is something that I might look at and say, you know, it's really bad acting, but actually it works for this story, and it gives it that TOS feel that I love. So I'm sort of kind of in between where all you guys are on this as well. I like the episode. One thing to point out is that, like, I find the guy, Morgan Earp, who's the guy who shoots Chekhov in the episode, his demeanor and all as he's walking, it's kind of weird. It's kind of creepy. Do you know what other role he played that was also weird and creepy in Star Trek? He is John, the weird guy in the desert at the beginning of Star Trek V. With
what?
The gun.
Really?
Yes. Same actor.
No.
Yeah.
No.
It's Rex Holman. And he played that role at the beginning.
A Vulcan.
Vulcan, yes. So when you make that connection, I don't know, that seems to be a real talent he has for awkward movements and facial expressions. But
anyway. How funny is that? Wow.
So I'm going to give this episode a half gallon of bourbon. Because that makes Scotty really happy. All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys. Before we go, Mariel, tell everyone where they can find you around what we're doing on the network and around the interwebs.
You can find me on Twitter, A Florida Girl, all separated by underscores. And you can also find me writing most of the news for Trek FM.
Absolutely. And Landry, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at 005, DOUBLEOFIVE. And they can find me on Standard Orbit every week, where Mike and I talk about TOS, sometimes with people who were involved in Star Trek-y things, which is always fun. I'm also we just recorded today an upcoming episode of Commentary Frack Stars with Mike, show that they're doing with Colin on Battlestar Galactica. I came up with the name, so they figured that I should be in some of the episodes. So,
hey, Drew, listen, I don't know if anybody has, and you can talk to, you know, to Mike about it, but I want to lay claim on Commentary Brack Stars when they do the Space Ghost podcast.
Okay.
So just
okay.
So you know, yeah.
All right.
I just want to lay claim on that.
So stay tuned for that, and also stay tuned for Mike and Drew's new World Wrestling Entertainment Show commentary, Smack Stars.
well. Stop. Now we're gonna do a sports podcast. Why?
All right. So thanks again for joining us today, guys. It's a lot of fun.
You know, Chris, it's been great talking to Mariel and Drew about TOS. I don't get to talk enough about the other Star Trek shows, and I absolutely love hearing other people's perspectives about Star Trek on the whole. And you mentioned A Fistful of Data's, but I kind of feel like this is the original Star Trek Western.
It is the original Star Trek Western. I'm like you. I don't get to talk about TOS very much either as far as the TV series goes. When I talk about TOS, it's usually about books or comics on literary treks. So it's always fun to go back and visit these episodes that I used to long ago own on VHS tape, purchased for $15 a pop at the bookstore in the mall back when I was in high school. And it's great to go back and revisit them now. And Spectre of the Gun, as I mentioned during the discussion, I had not seen in quite a long time. So it was a lot of fun. And I'm glad Mariel and Drew could join us as well. But, you know, the Wild Wild West isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Montgomery Scott.
It's really just their... to tell a story that they couldn't tell with Kirk or Spock or McCoy.
This is true. An episode where Kirk is framed for the murder of a hooker would be...
Right. Awesome.
Completely different.
But...
it would be awesome, but...
Earl Grey.
Ships of TNG Part 2.
Commander Riker, why would you protect the inferior ship? I want its treasure. I want the other ship.
Darren, how long have you been keeping that one in your pocket?
Yeah,
you
did not like
tell
that.
Us.
That was good.
Do a Ferengi.
The Ready Room.
Scientific method.
She tells the woman that comes on the bridge, and she's like, "Well, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter to me. I'm going to drive into these stars. It's going to be great." Like it's like I'm just like
the orb.
Till death do us part.
His are very quizzical in nature. They're of the scientist. They're of the somebody who is willing to accept, okay, what is this reality? What's going on? She's just all like, tell me what to do right now. You know, like,
right.
She, there's nothing spiritual about her.
To the journey!
One versus doctor's orders.
I was working full-time on top of being a full-time student, and I...
Listen, I don't want to hear your excuses, okay? I don't want to hear them.
Like, life was happening, and...
A great man once told me, if something's important to you, you make the time. Warp 5.
Undeveloped Enterprise stories.
But the idea here is that Porthos would become intelligent and would be the only member of the crew capable of communicating with a canine alien. So even Hoshi apparently couldn't figure out this dog language.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Fifth Bowl, Chimera.
I'd love to see an X-Files one shot with Scully and the hookers.
With, you know? Scully and the hookers?
Yeah.
That's a great name for a band.
We can call it Scully and the Hookers.
Melodic Treks.
Five musical favorites.
You know, I don't completely hate the opening theme. I just really think that Archer's theme should be the opening credits.
Continuing Mission.
Star Trek Axelar with Alec Peters.
That's what we posit. We say it makes sense that at this point we know it's from TOS. They're not integrated, so our crews are not integrated, and we make a point of that. We don't avoid it. We make a point of it. And in Prelude to Axanar, they talk about that.
Literary Treks.
IDW Alien Spotlight, Part 1.
Well, Chris, it's okay, because they can see the Romulans from their house.
That's right.
So, from space. You know, you betcha. You know what? That's okay. I can see the Romulans from my starship. It's going to be fine.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in a wide variety of places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download or stream from the website. And if you're over in iTunes, be sure to visit our new artist page and section inside the iTunes store. As we mentioned last week in news, we were extended an invitation by Apple for this new section, and it's given us a great ability to highlight our shows and past episodes, create special groupings for you. We have lots of category pages as well. And it's hard to believe, Daniel, but we are getting very close to 1,000 episodes of our podcasts here on the network. So there is a ton of stuff out there that you've probably never heard before. And through this new section in iTunes, we are going to be highlighting different shows for you. So go check it out. And the best way to get there is simply to go to itunes.com/trekfm. And that will take you right there inside your iTunes app. And also, while you're on iTunes, if you like the show, take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear from you. And also, it helps other listeners find the show as they're searching for Star Trek podcasts in iTunes and trying to find out, you know, where they can get their Star Trek news as well as their discussion. So again, take a moment and let us know what you think about the show and leave us a star rating. And not only for the Ready Room, but for, you know, all of our shows that you listen to as well. If you'd like to send us your feedback on the show today or anything about Star Trek, you can do that by going to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the show and about Star Trek. Lots of categories for you over there as well. And if social media is your thing, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek under username trekfm. Now, Daniel, when you're not, watching the makeout scenes with Chekhov and timing just how long it takes for him to warm up to that lady, where can people find you?
Of course, they can find me on the network at Earl Grey, where we're always talking about TNG stuff. So you can join me and my co-hosts Darren and Philip to talk about A Fistful of Datas or whatever we're talking about that week. So, and you can also find me occasionally here on the Ready Room as well. And finally on Twitter, I'm at username 1UpDan, and that is the number one, not the word.
And also, Daniel, you did an episode of Warp 5 with me about 2 weeks ago. We talked about the NX program. So if you want to hear
it was
all about Daniel's love for starships, go check that episode of Warp 5 out as well.
Absolutely.
Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, you can find me with Matthew Rushing on Literary Treks, where, as I mentioned a moment ago, we talk Star Trek books and comics, but we also interview authors. We actually do bring you those book extras that I said they should have on the Imzadi novel, where we actually find out directly from the author the process of writing the books and the ideas that they had that didn't make it into the novel. That's always interesting. Matthew and I also do The Orb together, where we talk about Deep Space Nine every week. And as I just mentioned, Warp 5 is a show I do that's all about Enterprise. I also have an interview show called Matter Stream about science and social issues and creative things that are inspired by Star Trek or loosely related to Star Trek. And then I have my new show, Continuing Mission, which is all about fan series and independent productions. So go check that out if you want to know what's going on beyond the 5 live action series and, of course, the animated series that we have. for things like Star Trek Continues, Renegades, Axanar, other things coming up. Lots of interesting discussions with the creators of those over there as well. Before we let you go, I'd like to tell you once again about our sponsor, Audible.com, the best source for audiobooks. Go pick up Inzadi by Peter David. Find out what's going on with Riker and Troy in that book, or pick any other book you'd like to read as well, because as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. The way you do that is by going to audibletrial.com/TrekFM and sign up and choose a book. And if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep that audiobook. That's yours. But by supporting Audible, you'll be helping us keep the Ready Room coming to you every week. Again, that's audibletrial.com/TrekFM. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network. One more thing you can do to help us keep the Ready Room coming is to make a donation to the network. Our shows are free for you to download, but they're not free for us to produce or distribute. And your support helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to get not only the show, but all of our other shows out to you every week. And I'd like to give a shout out to listener Greg Mullenby, who made a generous contribution to the network. We really appreciate your support, Greg. And for everyone else, if you'd like to join Greg in helping us make our shows, you can do that by going to trek.fm/donate. We have different contribution levels for you to choose from, as well as original Alien artwork for you. So go see what's right for you. Make a donation. Again, trek.fm/donate. We really, really appreciate your support in helping us keep everything going. All right, Daniel, well, I'm going to wander back down and see if Sylvia is free for that dance now that Chekhov is back on the bridge. Because when she wasn't making out with Chekhov, I think I caught her giving me the eye.
All right, Chris, well, it's time to stick a six-shooter in it because this Ready Room is done.